From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Americans place terrorist attacks high on their list of fears, yet very few people actually die in such attacks in this country. They legitimately fear gun violence, yet purchase more guns every time there is a mass shooting. Many support deportation of immigrants over fears of violence, yet immigrants commit fewer crimes per capita than native-born Americans. Parents are terrified of their children being kidnapped, yet actual child abduction rates are extremely low. Fears of vaccine dangers persist despite mountains of evidence to the contrary. And there is an active movement of doomsday preppers, very few of whom support action on climate change. Some might argue that the irrational fears plaguing this nation are exactly what gave rise to the presidency of Donald Trump. My guest is Sasha Abramski. He's an author, a freelance journalist, and a lecturer at the University of California. He's also a senior fellow at Demos. He's written for The Nation, Atlantic Monthly, New York Magazine, American Prospect, Salon, and many other outlets. And he's also written a number of books, including The American Way of Poverty, Inside Obama's Brain. And he now joins me to discuss his newest book, Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. Welcome to the program, Sasha.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So you start your book out talking about your very own personal experience of being in a place where you thought you were going to die to explore our collective fears to so many different issues. And your chapter is cryptically titled Sigua Toxin. Tell us that story of how you enter into this world of the fears that plague Americans.
Yeah, so I had been commissioned to write this book on fear. And before I really got into the reporting, my family and I went down to Chile for a couple of months. We went to learn Spanish. And I was 6,000 miles from home. And I got really, really sick. Got a whole bunch of health ailments that hit me, hit my heart, hit different parts of my body. And the doctors couldn't work out what was happening. And I came back to the States and went through this sort of battery of medical tests. And eventually, a cousin of mine who works as an infectious disease specialist said, well, look, we're never going to know exactly what's happened, but it's possible you picked up a fish toxin, a toxin called ciguatoxin. And there's no definitive test for this. You sort of reach that conclusion by a process of elimination based on the symptoms. But it's possible you have this neurotoxin in your body. And the thing about it is, if you have this neurotoxin, there's no treatment. It just sort of eventually comes out of your body, it comes out of your system. But in the process, it makes you feel pretty terrible, pretty scared for many, many months. And so I was caught in this situation where I didn't quite know what was wrong with me, but I knew something was wrong. And it made me very anxious. It made me very fearful. It made me not know what the future held. And I started thinking, I've got this book to write. I'm writing about anxiety. I'm writing about the way in which fear is now the sort of coin of our realm in America. It's the thing that binds us together. It's the thing that gives us political validity increasingly. And I started thinking that in some ways, what I was experiencing, the anxiety, the fear around this potential case of ciguatoxin, really was being magnified at a societal level. We knew we had things to fear. We were seeing these headlines about terrorism, about disease epidemics, about crime, about surging illegal immigration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was shaping the way that we were approaching life. And it was shaping the way that we were making political alliances or the way we were shaping our culture. It was even shaping the way we were parenting our kids. So yeah, it's a sort of cryptic first chapter, but that's the segue into this meditation on fear in America.
So it's a good way to segue into the fear of disease that we do have. And we can look back on, you know, bird flu and Ebola and the Zika virus, all of which you write about in your book. These become sensationalized often in the media as diseases that are plaguing another nation, and a few cases emerge in the U.S. setting off these huge fears among the American public of an epidemic wiping out part of our population. So why is that fear irrational? Because we are talking about infectious diseases, and maybe that irrational fear does save us from, you know, an epidemic.
Yeah, no, it's certainly the case that having some degree either of fear or at least awareness of potential epidemics is important because it does shape public health responses. It does allow us to liberate money for setting up medical systems, medical coverage in epicenters of the disease. It's useful. It's useful to be aware when a disease like Ebola becomes a part of our lives. On the other hand, when you look at Ebola or you look at bird flu or these other sort of headline stories that you mentioned, in actual fact, the number of Americans who died of these diseases was very small. The number of Americans who died of Ebola, I believe, was 4. And those were public health workers who had gone out to West Africa, which is where the disease epicenter was, and they had got infected while working in public health there. Now, what happens is it's a nasty disease. I mean, you read the headlines, you read the stories about Ebola, and it's guaranteed to get you in the gut. It's guaranteed to make you feel absolutely anxious and fearful. And it makes for a good headline precisely because of that. It's guaranteed an audience. And the media responds somewhat as a herd. So if one newspaper or one television show picks up Ebola, everyone else has got to follow suit. And suddenly you turn on the TV, you've got Ebola stories. You turn on the radio, you've got Ebola stories. You open your smartphone, clicking on the headlines, and Facebook is covering it, and Instagram's covering it, and Twitter's covering it. And it becomes this sort of omnipresent thing. But what fascinated me as I was researching this book is the things we don't fear. So while Ebola kills a few Americans, every single year, the flu kills tens of thousands of Americans. Every single year, asthma kills tens of thousands of Americans, or pneumonia. If you go globally, tuberculosis or malaria or diarrhea or HIV/AIDS are far bigger killers than Ebola is or was. And I think what really interests me is the way that we've lost the ability to calibrate risk. So we get scared not by the likelihood of something occurring or something infecting us, but by the amount of media time, the amount of headlines, the amount of clicks, news clicks that a story generates. So Ebola gets a lot of news clicks. We get very scared. Asthma gets relatively few news clicks, or flu gets relatively few news clicks. We treat it as a yawn. We ignore it. We don't modify our behavior as a result of it. And it's that disjunct, why we fear some things even though they're not particularly risky, and we ignore other things even though they really are very risky. That to me is sort of a fascinating story to tell.
Are these irrational fears very much spill over into parenting as well? And it's interesting, of course, these days we think of parenthood as a verb. We parent our children instead of just being parents. And there is a very brisk healthy industry of parenting books and advice, columns and documentaries and videos that help parents become increasingly paranoid about the impacts they'll have on their children. And you and I are both parents, so I'm sure, you know, I know I've been susceptible to these. But there's this, the biggest fear that parents seem to have is that someone's going to snatch their child. And it keeps parents from being able to let their children, you know, just go to their neighbor's house across the street. So how real are rates of child abduction, and how real is parents' fear that their child will get abducted?
Well, the fear is real. When you talk to parents, and I've gone around the country talking to parents, the fear is absolutely real. You have one story after another story after another story of terrible things happening to children. And parents get very anxious, and they respond by never letting their kids out of their sight. They don't let kids walk to school by themselves. They don't let kids go to the playground by themselves. They don't let kids just walk around the corner to visit a friend without being supervised.
And society actually criminalizes parents who do allow their children some leeway, right? Because it's not just individuals.
What you've seen, especially in America, but it's not just America, England, Canada, Australia, the Anglo-legal system, for various reasons, in recent years has actually begun really going after parents as being negligent or somehow malicious parents if they do give those kids a degree of freedom. And so, you know, one of the stories I write about in my book is this couple in a suburb outside of DC who had made a decision that their kids were intelligent enough, smart enough, savvy enough to walk to the playground and walk around the neighborhood alone. It was a brother and sister. And they were doing so, and they were doing so perfectly safely. They were following the rules. They were looking before they crossed the street. They weren't approaching and talking to strangers. They were doing all the right things. But they still got stopped by the police. And the police took those kids, and then Child Protective Services got involved. And then the parents got a knock on the door from Child Protective Services. And then they got all this legally threatening letters saying, unless you agree to sign these documents saying you won't let the kids roam the streets, you're going to be prosecuted. The kids are going to be at risk of being taken by Child Protective Services and put into foster care. Now, it was a completely absurd story. And I thought, you know, surely this is an anomaly. And then I started doing the research, and it turned out you could find stories all over the country like that. There were young women who were arrested after leaving their children for 2 or 3 minutes in a car while they went shopping. There were other people who had had job interviews and had sat the children down in the food mall at the food court at the mall, right next to where they were being interviewed, and they were still arrested for neglecting their children. Now, this is extraordinary. I mean, when I was growing up, and I assume when you were growing up, parents routinely let their children roam the neighborhood and explore their environment. It's a way that you learn independence. It's a way that you learn how to navigate the world. And it's eventually a way that you go from being that child for whom everything is done to being the adult who has to actually stand on his or her own 2 feet. If you take that away, if you say, look, we're going to expand childhood so that even teenagers don't walk to school or take the bus or train to school by themselves, but they're driven everywhere. Even teenagers aren't allowed out by themselves to go to a cafe or to go out to the movies with friends. If you take away that independence, you create a generation of people who doesn't know how to navigate adulthood. And that's dangerous.
Does that in turn then feed more fearful adults?
Absolutely. If you grow up thinking that you are potential prey for predators, you're going to take that with you into adulthood. And when you yourself become a parent, you're going to be nervous. You're going to be scared. You're going to be overprotective. So it does impact the next generation. But the other thing it impacts is political choices. And, you know, part of my book, not all of the book, but part of the book is about what happens politically when we're scared of everything and everyone. When we look at somebody and we assume they're up to no good. When we look at strangers in particular and we assume that they are out to hurt us or to take what is ours. It shifts the politics and it gives an opening to demagogy. It gives an opening to someone like Donald Trump, who's going to come in and say, look, you have problems, and those problems are because of all these enemies out there. And I'll fix those problems by cracking down on the enemies. I'll ban Muslims. I'll build a border wall. I'll give the police more power to beat up suspects, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when you open that door, or when you take the lid off that Pandora's box, what you do is you create this bottomless spiral. You create this spiral downwards into more and more and more fear, more and more and more social anxiety, and all of the coarsening of politics that goes with that.
So let's talk about the intersection of our fears that of the collective fears Americans have and racism, which is, of course, exactly the kind of thing that Trump has built his power on. And you talk about a lot in your book. And this is not something that just impacts, you know, the right wing Americans who are waving Confederate flags. Right. This is something that, because fear is irrational, it impacts the progressive person who you know, considers themselves anti-racist, but inadvertently clutches their bag tighter when a black man walks on the sidewalk in front of them. How does irrational fear feed racism?
You know, one of the really interesting research areas that psychologists and neuroscientists are doing at the moment is on an area called implicit bias. And implicit bias is this idea that you don't even need to be consciously racist in order to, at a very deep part of your personality, harbor racist stereotypes or racial assumptions. And there's this project called Project Implicit that was put together by Harvard and scientists at Harvard and various other institutions. And it's an online test, and you can take it yourself. You can go onto the Project Implicit site, and it's a speed test. It pairs various images and it times the response. And one of the most disconcerting things is that when you pair an image of a black person and something bad, most people respond faster than when you pair an image of a black person and something good. That deep, deep within us, we have this assumption of blackness and badness. We don't have to be consciously racist. We can be someone who spends all of their conscious energies fighting racism. But those cultural stereotypes are so deep that you see measurable changes in response time. And the Project Implicit team has done permutations on this. They've done responses to blackness, they've done responses to Muslims, responses to gays, responses even to women in the workplace. And you can see the ways in which deep, deep within us, cultural stereotypes take root. Now, that's really important. If you're a police officer and you're confronting somebody and you're not sure whether or not that person is armed, whether or not they're carrying a gun, and you have to make a split-second decision. If you have these implicit biases, you don't have to be consciously racist. You don't have to be a deliberately nasty person, but you may still jump to the wrong conclusion. You may still make that split-second judgment call that the black person is carrying a gun and that you have to respond in kind. And when you magnify that, not just to the individual, but to organizations, to institutions, to the way that we as a culture construct our politics or construct our law enforcement priorities, you start getting into this whole hornet's nest of problems, because unconscious racism in a complicated, diverse society can be almost as toxic as conscious racism.
So the problem, of course, is that when we do have these fears, it's what we do about them that matters, right? So yes. When we have these unconscious fears, one thing you can do if you're somebody who just doesn't personally know that many people of color is try to put yourself in situations where you just have a more diverse circle of friends. So you literally learn to become comfortable with people who are different from you. Especially as a white person, I think, of course, that is important. It impacts where you live, how you live, how you function, et cetera. But then it's also a matter of what you do, what sorts of policies you might support. It does matter if you, politically support an end to racial profiling, even if you might have an implicit bias. But then there's also the kinds of the problem that I come up against often, Sasha, is, for example, every time I talk about, say, vaccines or vaccinations, yep. Guaranteed, even this conversation will garner me emails from listeners and viewers who are very upset that I can claim vaccines are safe. So you can present mountains of evidence to some people, and that actually serves to help them dig their heels in even more in the face of fact. Is that an inherently human response?
I think it is. I mean, fear essentially plays on emotion at least as much as reason. And so if you're emotionally committed to a point of view, or you have a set of fears that you've constructed an identity around, and you have a bunch of experts telling you, look, your fears are irrational, your emotions are wrong, you need to recalibrate how you're thinking about this issue, it's possible some people will say, oh, yes, I'm overreacting, I should slow down, I should take a deep breath, I should work out whether or not what I'm saying makes sense. But a lot of people are going to actually say, well, look, experts have an agenda. And the suspicion of experts in our culture is so profound at the moment, whether it's medical experts, legal experts, whether it's political professionals, whatever it might be. We are deeply suspicious as a culture of expertise. Now, in such an environment, it becomes possible to say, well, you have all this scientific evidence in favor of vaccines, but I know from anecdote that vaccines triggers autism. Or you have all this scientific evidence in favor of climate change, but I think it's a Chinese hoax. And I
or you think could it's cite you could cite like hoax. One or two experts who are on your side, and you know, that's it may right. Turn out that those people are in the absolute minority, well, but at least you've got some so-called experts.
You can find the experts, or you can lean on alternative facts, this nonsensical oxymoronic phrase that's now become part of the lexicon. Alternative facts aren't alternative facts, they're falsehoods, but they're amplified and they're repeated in social media in particular in a way that doesn't in any way, shape, or form show them to be alternative facts. Quite the opposite. It creates these echo chambers. And this sort of segues into another aspect of the whole thing of fear. We've always had episodes in human history where large numbers of people have been preoccupied by particular fears, whether rational or irrational, particular anxieties. The difference in our moment is that we have technology now, especially with social media, that can ricochet those fears globally instantly. We compress time, we compress space with our technology. Now, what that means is that if you have a story about, let's say, vaccines and autism, you don't have to fact check it, you don't have to peer review it. You just upload it, you put it online, you put it on Facebook, you tweet about it, and you have a potential global audience. And that global audience opens the story and clicks on it. And every time someone opens that story, the numbers of people who viewed it goes up. And those numbers serve to validate. If we see a story online and it's got a million clicks, implicitly we think, oh, it has a million clicks because it's a good, accurate, truthful story. And so it becomes this sort of self-reinforcing situation. And I think the danger of our moment is that we're losing the ability to actually calculate properly. Is a story sensible? Is it using good sources? Is the data that's being used plausible? Is it accurate? And sometimes it is, but oftentimes when you actually spend a minute or two thinking about it, it just doesn't make any sense. But we're not spending that minute or two. We're not slowing down enough to actually look for the context in the news that we're absorbing.
So, Sasha, definitely it seems to be not a stretch that we attribute the election of Donald, electoral college victory of Donald Trump, to these fears, their social media role, the role of the media, traditional media as well, et cetera. So the question is, what can we do about this? There's been in the news this idea that Donald Trump, while his popularity overall continues to remain dismal, among his base, the support remains stronger than ever. And every irrational action he takes serves to actually solidify his support among that minority of Americans that may propel him to a re-election victory. What do we do about these irrational fears if rationality doesn't, or presenting people with the rationality and the actual facts doesn't work?
Well, I think there are two different stories there. The first is that politically, you're never going to have 100% of the public disavowing a particular president or a particular party. That's just realistically not going to happen. So the fact that Trump has this diehard group of somewhere between 25 and 32 or 33% of the electorate who is going to stay with him to the bitter end, that's less significant than what happens to those people on the other side. The people who might have held their nose and voted for Trump, but never really trusted him, never really liked the lurch towards conspiracism, never really liked the lurch towards violence. What happens to those people? And I think that's where you can have a conversation. You can say to people, look, I understand you, for various reasons, decided that Trump was a less bad or a better alternative than Clinton. You, for various reasons, decided that the Republicans' broader agenda, tax cuts, deregulation, and so on, made sense to you. Now, that's something you decided in 2016. Now look at what's happening. Look at the scapegoating that's going on. Look at the way in which fear is being stoked and manipulated. Look at the way in which the language of politics is being coarsened. Look at the violence that's being unleashed as those fears are stoked. Do you want to hitch yourself to that story as it progresses? And to me, that's where the conversation is going to take place. You know, I know I've talked to enough Trump supporters to know there are some people who, doesn't matter what I say, doesn't matter what evidence I present, are still going to believe everything that comes out of Trump's mouth or that he tweets at 4 a.m. before he's been corralled by his aides. Now, those people might view it as entertainment, or they might view it as a reinforcement of fears they've long had but were afraid to express in public, or they might view it as a finger in the eye of a cultural elite they were long contemptuous of and felt beholden to. There are many reasons those people are going to stay with Trump. But the question is, will the responsible political leadership stay with Trump as he lurches further and further into irrationality? Will commentators stay with Trump? Will think tanks that, again, held their nose but lended their support to Trump because of tax cuts or because they didn't like environmental regulations, will they stick with Trump as the irrationality intensifies? And I think that's where there's tremendous room to build opposition and to build alternatives, because there's an awful lot of people who have different politics from what you have or what I may have, but who at the end of the day are no more keen to live in a world defined by irrationality than you or I. And I think that's the people we have to talk with.
Well, Sasha, I want to end our conversation with the longer term, because, of course, Trump will come and go. The question is, those forces that propelled him into power do remain. And I want to pick up on what you brought up earlier, which is the skepticism towards experts. And to some extent, expertise, academics have a little bit fed into that skepticism. You know, we have a history in this country of scientific racism, for example. We have a history in this country of scientists having given into big pharma's dollars, which feeds that skepticism. Can experts, can academics, scholars do something to create a better culture where facts are better embraced in our society?
I do think that for all the reasons you mentioned, you know, it's not entirely unhealthy to be skeptical. Yeah. But I do think there's a difference between healthy skepticism and the sort of nihilism that we're seeing today. And what I mean by that is, at the moment, we're seeing a nihilism which basically says any and all expertise is bad. It doesn't matter where it comes from, doesn't matter its reasoning, doesn't matter its motivations, expertise per se is bad. And it's a very bullying idea. It's this sort of talk radio idea that you outsmart people by insulting them. You don't outsmart them by thinking with them or arguing with them, but you insult them. And anybody who writes about Trump at the moment gets emails, you stupid person, you idiot, you this, that, and the other, I'm going to hurt you, I'm going to threaten you. And it's a very intimidating culture that is being unleashed. So, you know, what do academics do about it? One thing is they shine a spotlight on it. It's the role of the academy, it's the role of intellectuals, especially public intellectuals, to talk about what's happening, to try and analyze it, to try and explain it, to try and show all the flaws in the system. And not to necessarily say, we have all the answers. Nobody has all the answers. I mean, for a scientist to say, look, I have all the answers, I don't need to have the input of community, that's arrogant in the extreme. But for the community to say, we have no need of scientists, that's also arrogant. And there has to be a middle ground. There has to be a way, for example, to create land policy or water policy or policies on pesticides, which use scientific expertise. Because I don't know the danger level of arsenic in my water. I don't know the danger level of pesticides that I'm dealing with. If I eat a certain amount, is it going to hurt me? If I work with a certain amount, is it going to hurt me? But if you take away the role of scientists, which is what the Trump administration is doing, if you deregulate, if you essentially leave it up to businesses, you essentially say, all right, the regulatory agencies, the EPA, the public health institutes, all these agencies that are responsible for ensuring our safety as individuals and as a society. If you say those agencies are going to roll back and stand down, you worsen everybody's lives. You make individuals' lives more dangerous, and you make the social life as a whole more vulnerable. And I think that that's just a terrible road we're going down right now.
Well, Sasha, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you again.
My guest is Sasha Abramski, an author, freelance journalist, and a lecturer at the University of California and a senior fellow at Demos. We've been discussing his new book, Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.